This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why an Italian restaurant in Milwaukee is worried about a cash crunch in China. Washington and Colorado prepare for a brand new market in recreational marijuana. And if your alma mater had a scent, what would it be? Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, June 24th. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. It's good to have you with us. We've said it before and we'll say it again. There are two things that can really get the markets in a tizzy: Ben Bernanke and China. We get the Fed chairman, interest rates and all, but China? Well, yes, China's economic woes help push the markets down today. China's in the midst of what's essentially a government-imposed credit crunch, sticking a pin in a giant lending bubble. Marketplace's Mark Garrison looks at how credit in China affects our pocketbooks here in the U.S.
Barbier's Italian, how can I help you?
As China's loan situation goes, so goes a beloved Italian restaurant in South Milwaukee. Bet you didn't see that one coming. The Caterpillar plant across the street makes mining equipment that scoops up raw materials to feed Chinese industry. Cat business is 20% of the restaurant's revenue, so manager Matt Willers keeps an eye on world economic news.
Constantly, you can't help but be immersed in what's going on globally.
The kitchen that churns out pizza and pasta is a front row seat as to how Caterpillar's doing. It's high on the list of American companies that will suffer in a Chinese credit crunch. If big firms there can't get easy money, there'll be less mining and construction, which is bad for Cat and the nearby Italian joint. But FTN Financial chief economist Chris Lowe points out the other side of that coin.
It also means cheaper commodities, and long run, that might not be such a bad thing.
Think lower energy costs for Americans. Also, tighter lending in China will hurt banks, but maybe not Chinese consumers American firms want to sell to. It could accelerate China's transition to an economy relying less on big projects funded with cheap money and more on Chinese consumers buying things.
An adjustment in China, however severe it might be, to more of a consumption-driven economy, in the long run actually benefits most American companies.
That's Patrick Chovanec of Silvercrest Asset Management. That shift will have impact around the world, even under the stamped tin ceiling of a Wisconsin Italian restaurant. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The Supreme Court's term is coming to an end, and a lot of their rulings are affecting business in this country. Today's case, Vance versus Ball State, is the latest. A woman who worked in the kitchen at Ball State University claimed her supervisor had harassed her. At issue was the definition of the word supervisor. The court ruled 5-4 in favor of the university. The ruling is the latest in what many see as a very business-friendly Supreme Court. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
When the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Ball State, it stated that an employer is not liable in discrimination cases unless the supervisor accused of discrimination not just supervises, but has the power to hire and fire.
There's no doubt that this decision is pro-employer. This is a decision that reduces the situations in which employers can be held liable for the actions of their supervisors.
Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of the University of California, Irvine School of Law.
In fact, this has been a pattern during all of the 8 years of the Roberts Court.
The Roberts Court has also made multiple decisions on class action lawsuits involving large groups of individuals who band together to sue companies.
About 7 cases this term that implicate class action rights, and in all but one, they have limited people's ability to band together to bring class actions.
Deepak Gupta is a plaintiff-side appellate lawyer who's argued on behalf of consumers and employees in front of the Supreme Court.
These are cases that often seem quite technical. They involve issues like class action rules and arbitration and preemption, and most people fall asleep when they hear that.
As a result, Gupta says these types of cases often get overshadowed by the big blockbuster rulings involving civil rights.
But they actually have, I think, a much bigger impact on our everyday lives as consumers and workers.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
China, the Fed, lots to worry about on Wall Street today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The words global tourism, you probably don't think Pakistan. But that country has been trying very hard the last few years to attract foreigners, especially mountaineers ambitious enough to try climbing some of the highest peaks in the world. They now have an even bigger problem in Pakistan. This past weekend, Islamic militants killed 10 foreign climbers and their Pakistani guide. Joining us to talk about how this will affect tourism in the region is Elizabeth Becker. She's the author of a recent book on global tourism. Ms. Becker, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here.
What can you tell us about this area of Pakistan? What's it like and who travels there?
This is not the average tourist destination, obviously. This is for what are called adventure tourists, mountaineers. This is for a very, very small number of people.
What do you think the effect will be on Pakistan's tourist economy?
Well, it's a pretty feeble economy right now after more than a decade of conflict. But the tourism industry in Pakistan was on the way up. It did not need this. It's going to hurt it. This incident will just put a big glaring spotlight on one of the few areas that were working for Pakistan's tourism economy. I mean, there's not much left, but this does not come at a good time at all.
And your point is Pakistan's tourist economy was pretty feeble in the first place. Right.
Yeah. And but nonetheless, I mean, they rightfully, I mean, give everyone credit. There's been an immediate and strong reaction. They're going to try to catch the culprits. They are going to try to bring in security measures. But it's just, this is not an isolated instance. Remember back not so long ago when foreign tourists were being kidnapped by Somali pirates in eastern Africa?
Right.
Those Somali pirates, what was the easiest target for them? It was tourists. This is a very gruesome example of a larger problem. When tourism becomes a $6.4 trillion global industry, tourists have a different role in the world than they used to have.
Would you travel to Pakistan now?
I have to say that I'm very partial to India, but I would still go to India to do a trek in the Himalayas. Yes, I would.
Elizabeth Becker. She's the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Ms. Becker, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
By voter initiative, recreational marijuana will be fully legal next year in Colorado and Washington, unless the Justice Department intervenes before that, since growing, dealing, or selling pot is still a felony under federal law. But for now, each state is furiously drafting regulations to set up the first ever regulated commercial cannabis markets in the world. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman headed out of his bureau in Portland and into the soon-to-be free-smoking state of Washington.
So let's get right into the weeds, and I promise that's my last pun. The Washington Liquor Control Board will license the production and sale of recreational marijuana and tax it, which could bring the state several hundred million dollars a year. That means certify locally grown pot for potency and being free of pesticides and molds, just like kale at the local grocery store. Decide if there can be a pot store at every corner or one in every community. Monitor greenhouses to make sure the certified stuff doesn't get diverted to the black market. And, crucially, set a proper price for pot down the corner store.
I'm weighing out 4 grams of this alien chem dog for this gentleman here. He's one of our regulars.
Forrest Escobedo is behind the counter at a dispensary for medical marijuana in downtown Olympia, Washington.
We have more of a connoisseur kind of place, like high quality for a really affordable price.
The potent stuff he sells to medical customers costs around $10 a gram. It's roughly 2 joints worth, enough to get high twice. Escobedo's considering applying for a license to sell recreational pot to any adult, but that would almost certainly mean raising his prices. The state's going to tack on about 40% in taxes. And the thing is, the state actually wants to push pot prices higher.
A low price encourages heavy use.
That's Mark Kleiman. He's a drug policy expert at UCLA who's working with Washington state regulators. See, even though the state is setting up a whole new system to sell pot, it doesn't want to encourage tens of thousands of new pot smokers, people smoking away their paychecks.
Price matters more to heavy users than to light users. It matters more to poor people than to rich people. Most teenagers don't have very much disposable income. So low price is a particular risk in terms of underage use. And if the price is low enough in Washington, then somebody might want to buy it in Washington and ship it out of state.
But the state doesn't want the price in its licensed stores to be too high either. Because if the price inside the store is way higher than the price out on the street, the illegal black market will keep thriving. Randy Simmons is at the Washington Liquor Control Board.
You don't want to tax it to the point where you're pricing yourself out of a marketplace. But right now, we're having to compete with somebody else that's growing.
Those black market growers are already flooding the West Coast with relatively cheap, high-quality marijuana. The danger is they'll just keep producing and selling, avoiding the state's 40% tax markup, undercutting the state's stores. Think moonshiners versus revenue officers at the end of Prohibition. And as this industry grows up and goes straight with professional growers and distributors and retail chains, it's going to get even harder for the state to prevent really cheap pot.
Once you legalize cannabis, production costs are going to drop dramatically.
Bo Kilmer co-directs the RAND Drug Policy Research Center.
Right now, when someone purchases marijuana, a lot of what they're doing is compensating the drug dealer and everyone else along that supply chain for the risk of arrest, risk of incarceration, risk of violent assault. With legalization, that goes away.
So the challenge here? As more and more legal pot hits the market, make sure it doesn't get so cheap that we have a runaway public health crisis on our hands. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
geranium, lavender, iced juniper, white pepper.
So what does your alma mater smell like? First, though, let's do the numbers. What to fret about if you're an investor? A potential credit crisis in China or higher interest rates here in the U.S.? Take your pick. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave back 139 points, nearly 1%, to land at 14,659. The NASDAQ erased 36 points, 1%, to end at 3320. The S&P 500 dropped 19 points, 1.2%, to 1573. Hewlett Packard powered down 3%. Apple sliced off 2 2/3. it's hovering just above $400 a share. In China, the Shanghai Composite Index fell more than 5%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng lost more than 2%. Britain's FTSE, France's CAC 40, and Germany's DAX each lost more than 1%. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note settled at 2.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes and durable goods orders for May. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee talks about the federal minimum wage. It was 25 cents an hour in 1938. Today, it's $7.25. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. Tomorrow at Georgetown University, President Obama will give a long-awaited speech on climate change. Now, he hasn't talked much about climate change for quite some time. The issue went dormant during his reelection race. But it looks like the president is set to impose new regulations aimed at cutting carbon pollution. And you can bet Obama will argue for them by talking about the social cost of carbon. What's that, you may ask? Here's Marketplace sustainability reporter Scott Tong.
When you and I litter, we call it bad. Economists like to use bigger words, like externality, something that hurts the surrounding environment.
Greenhouse gases are externalities on steroids.
That's environmental economist Michael Greenstone at MIT.
They produce damages that go way into the future.
Here's what he means. Take a gallon of gas. I just paid $3.69 on Lee Highway by my house. But the world pays a price, too. It's like a planetary secondhand smoke problem, except we're all puffing CO2.
It remains in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. It's going to change the climate for centuries, and that will produce changes that impose damages on my children and their children and their children.
How much damage is an estimate called the social cost of carbon? For years, the federal government's number was the equivalent of 22 cents of damage per gallon of gas burned. On a larger scale, that's about $22 a ton of carbon. Last month, it was up to 36 cents, based on new science and new expensive climate events like storm patterns.
There's now an increasing awareness that this is going to put a lot of coastlines, I think Miami's a prime example, in real danger. We also learned from Hurricane Sandy that it's not just predictable flooding, but rather storm surges that could impose costs.
The president tomorrow is expected to push power plants to spew less carbon. That will cost money, says economist Matthew Kahn at UCLA.
This means that when a coal-fired power plant generates electricity to allow households to surf the internet or to allow a grocery store to refrigerate fish sticks, that utility's going to have to pay that bill, and they're likely to raise electricity prices.
It's a cost. On the other hand, there's a benefit to having less carbon, and saving $36 in pollution for every ton of carbon not burned is a big benefit. Economist Billy Pizer teaches at Duke.
Obviously, we'd rather be doing regulations where the benefits outweigh the cost. So having a higher social cost of carbon does make the case more compelling for a greater amount of regulation.
Pizer does admit that climate math is tricky for governments that are doing it and for companies that are doing it.
At some level, there's a bit of subjectivity that comes into play. There's going to be uncertainty about these things no matter what we do.
Like the uncertainty of what your retirement fund is going to look like someday. The White House says its carbon damage estimate is in the mid-range of the estimates out there. But UCLA's Matthew Kahn thinks it may be too high. He says when seas rise, don't assume all the coastal houses will be doomed. Homeowners will adapt.
When we anticipate a new threat, rational households and firms will move to higher ground. Those in currently at-risk areas will either invest in stilts and other devices, hard seawalls, to protect themselves, or they will retreat.
So, he argues, climate change could be less costly than we think. Perhaps. But there's one thing virtually every environmental economist agrees on, that the social cost of carbon, the damage to the future, is not valued at zero. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A supply and demand story you might not have heard. Apparently, ammunition is in short supply in this country. That's been the case for a while now. A lot of retailers are putting limits on how much ammo a customer can buy. At Walmart, for instance, it's 3 boxes a day. So some gun owners are getting creative and making their own bullets. Marketplace's David Gura looked into it.
There is no 9mm ammo at Hotshot Sports in Schnecksville, Pennsylvania. The store's owner, Walt Schneck, says it's the most common caliber.
Demand right now is over the top.
It's been that way, Schneck says, since the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut.
People got panicky. They're coming out buying guns and they're buying ammo and everything is just going off the shelf.
In the U.S., ammunition is a $2 billion industry. Larry Keene is with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. That's the firearms industry's trade association.
Well, all of the manufacturers are operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to try to produce as much as they can to meet this unprecedented consumer demand.
Last month, Remington announced it's expanding its ammunition factory in Arkansas. Still, manufacturers haven't been able to keep up, and Walt Schneck says many of his customers at Hotshot Sports have started to make their own ammo. They do it from scratch, or they reload casings from ammo they've shot.
As long as you can get the bullet, the powder, and the primer, and you have the casings, you're good to go.
There are other benefits. Rodney James is the author of the ABCs of Reloading. For one thing, it's more precise, he says. You can tailor a round to an individual firearm. For another,
you can reduce the cost of your ammunition by about 60%. If you basically assemble it yourself at home.
To do that, James says, you need a press, dies, and manuals to figure out how much powder to use.
You can put together a pretty good reloading outfit for a few $100, $250, $300.
So coming into the reloading area here down my basement, what we're going to see is I have a couple different workbenches set up.
Tim Miller is one of Walt Schneck's customers. He lives in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Miller is a competitive shooter and a firearms instructor who makes his own ammo. He teaches a class on this. It's 8 hours, $250.
This is all the stuff I picked up from when I shot. It needs to be clean first, because if you don't clean it, it'll clog up your dies and can actually dent the cases.
Today, Miller is making 38 specials for a revolver. He resizes the cartridge and puts in a new primer. That's what'll ignite the gunpowder, which he puts in next. Then he seats a projectile, the bullet. It's a precise process. In a matter of minutes, Miller cranks out round after round. He estimates he can make about 300 in 1 hour.
The rounds will take the range today.
At Hotshot Sports, Miller would have to pay almost $250 for 500 rounds of factory-made 38 specials. He says he could make 500 rounds himself for $77.
So you're about $7 for the powder, about $50 for the bullets, and about $20 for the primer, and that's 500. So there's a drastic difference.
But it's not as easy to get those components as it used to be. Here's Rodney James again, who wrote the ABCs of Reloading.
As there's been a run on guns and ammunition, there's also been a similar run, although on a smaller scale, on reloading equipment and components.
Including the bullets, the projectiles that go into ammunition. So some people also make those themselves. Jim Finnerty is one of them. He lives in Groton, Massachusetts.
You can really save a fortune by making your own bullets as well, because after the brass case, which you get to reuse, the bullet or projectile is the second most expensive component of the cartridge.
Finnerty says he got into making bullets and ammo for economic reasons. Then it became a hobby.
I mean, if I had taken up golf, I'd be at the driving range practicing every day. And if there was a shortage of golf balls and there was a way to make my own, I'd probably do it.
These days, more and more gun owners like Finnerty say it's becoming a necessity. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There is a reason colleges and universities do very little paid advertising. We do it for them, for free. T-shirts, shot glasses, baseball caps, and all sorts of other stuff bearing college logos and brands. That is a $4.6 billion business. And wait till you get a whiff of what schools are putting their names on now. Sally Herschup says more.
Would you like to smell like your college? Well, your college thinks you would. Notre Dame is coming out with a perfume. ND Gold Eau de Toilette for men and for women, Lady Irish. The fragrance will be joining bottles from schools like Penn State, Auburn, and the University of North Carolina.
As people buy their merchandise and their shirts, they're going to buy everything with the brand on it.
Especially if they went to a school with a big sports team. Eric Smallwood is a vice president with Front Row Marketing, a sports marketing firm. He says no other group of sports fans is as devoted as fans of college teams. They go back generations. A T-shirt with a logo? Just not enough.
You want to live, breathe, and smell and be like the brand day in and day out.
Like sweaty socks, locker rooms, and stale beer? Or, as one alum from the University of Southern California put it, daddy's money, Bentley exhaust, and bro vomit. Actually, there's a different kind of nostalgia at work here.
Geranium, lavender, iced juniper, white pepper.
Katie Mossick is the CEO of Mossick.com, the company that created and sells many of the college scents for about $60. And she was describing the perfume of UNC, home to the Tar Heels.
So we say, okay, where is the school located geographically? Is it in the north? You know, is it in the south? Is it near the beach? Or is it more in the mountains?
School colors also count, so Harvard Crimson could translate into notes of pomegranate or apple, and MIT... maybe a smart student there is working on a scent for student debt. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We've been asking you on Twitter what your alma mater smells like. Pizza, fresh-cut grass, maybe PBR. My favorite, Dartmouth. Smells like snow. Winter is always coming. Keep yours coming and tell us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace APM.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, hold on to your thin mints, people. An Iowa congressman is calling for an inquiry by the House Ways and Means Committee into the finances of the Girl Scouts. Democrat Bruce Braley says he's worried that the longtime organization is selling its famous Samoas and Thin Mints to fund pension plans for employees rather than camping and other traditional Girl Scout activities. The Girl Scouts pension plan has a nearly $350 million deficit right now, and layoffs at the national headquarters are coming in August. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 139 points, nearly 1%. The NASDAQ erased 36 points, 1%. And the S&P 500 dropped 18 points, 1.1%. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Sarah Gardner. Join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.